Hey there, everybody. It is August 1st, 2013, and you are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line. Send that email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Strolling over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. And of course, right there on their homepage, you can submit questions for our relationship expert, Dr. Frankie, and you can participate in our $10,000 fundraising challenge where we're trying to get 1,000 people to give $10 each to raise money for the San Francisco to LA AIDS ride. You can follow us on Twitter. If you start following us, we'll probably start using it more. I don't know. We'll see how that works. And of course, go to the Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. A jam-packed episode for this week. We must get started. Well, a few weeks back, I mentioned to you all that I was in the middle of reading a riveting memoir entitled Oddly Normal. As soon as I finished that last page, I knew this was a story that I wanted to feature here on our program, and thus I am pleased to welcome the author, John Schwartz, to our show. John is a national correspondent for the New York Times. Officially, his beat focuses on infrastructure, but he has served as the paper's legal correspondent, he was a member of the paper's science staff, and occasionally he pops up in the New York Times book review, the Science Times Arts and Culture section, and writes a humor column for the business section's Mutual Funds Quarterly. In addition to Oddly Normal, he is the author of Short, Walking Tall, When You're Not Tall at All. John Schwartz, welcome to The Show Is So Gay.
Ken, thank you so much. What an introduction. I'm not going to be able to say anything yet. I'm just going to be glowing.
That's how we butter up the guests and then we break them down. No, that's not true. We don't do that here.
Don't savage me. Oh, okay.
We don't do that here. Well, the subtitle of the book is One Family Struggle to Help Their Teenage Son Come to Terms with His Sexuality. And when I saw that on the shelf, I thought, all right, well, this is going to be just so specifically personal, but it resonates so much more than that. I mean, as a gay Jew from northern New Jersey whose best friends all went to French Woods, I could connect this book. I know, right? When you were writing it, were you thinking, how is this going to reach other people?
That was the question from the start.
Yeah.
As I worked through, we knew we had been through something exceptional with raising Joe. We also knew that some of the experiences had to be a broader experience.
Yeah.
And I also knew that the way that I write and report, that these very personal stories can be broadened with research and bringing in other information. So I felt that we could take it bigger if we did tell the story. And keeping in mind the whole time that if all we told was the story of raising Joe, if all we told was his trouble in elementary school and his suicide attempt in seventh grade and everything that happened afterwards, it's basically a really bad Christmas letter.
Right.
You know, this happened and this happened and this happened and this happened. It's not a book. It's not a story anyone else needs to read. And so I wouldn't have taken it on if I didn't think we could do more.
Right there on the cover, you have the word family. Talk to me about the process of getting everybody signed on to participate in this, because it's not just about you.
Well, right. And, you know, I'm a reporter and I'm a goofball, and I've written a lot of first person pieces for every paper I've ever worked for about family stuff, funny stories about kids and, you know, drawing lessons from things my kids have said at various times. This was really different. These were very searing personal experiences and so, I talked to my wife about it, starting out with her saying, do you think this is a book that we could do? Do you think this is a story that we should tell? And she really saw that right away. And so I wondered whether I shouldn't propose a book. So the next step was to go to Joe.
Right.
And say, and we did this in the car on a drive. And I said, you know, I'm thinking of taking what we've been through and writing a book. And he said, this is a year and a half after the suicide attack.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, yeah, you should do that.
Said, that's an endorsement.
I said, wait a minute. You know, you're talking off the top of your head. It's a very difficult story. It's not, you're going to be the hero of the tale, but you know, it's not easy. And I'm going to talk about the hospital. I'm going to talk about the pills. And he looked at me and said, I said, do it. Okay.
I don't think you argue with that.
No. No, but we discussed it more. You know, the fact is, by that time, he had been going to the teen discussion group at the Gay Center in New York City for more than a year. And he knew the power of sharing stories. And he had heard a lot of stories. You know, it's not just that he's on Facebook and there's no such thing as a secret or privacy with a kid like this these days.
Right.
That's not it, though it's part of it. What's really going on, what was really okay for him was that you tell a story and you help somebody else.
Yeah. Well, one of the things, one of the many things that I just loved about this text is that it's more than about Joe is gay. And there are any number of texts out there where you have the parents or indeed the author himself who it is not just core to their identity, but it seems to be, it eclipses everything else in their life. And Joe's got more going on than just being gay.
Well, exactly right. There were his behavior in elementary school was really odd. There was a diagnosis a week, people trying to offer us diagnoses and telling us he needed treatment. There were screaming fights with various teachers, and there were suggestions that he was on the autism spectrum, that he had ADHD, that he might be bipolar. And you know, for one thing, I think that this is why you're not going to see Oddly Normal, the movie.
Right.
Because it's a real human story, and we are a lot of things. And if it was one thing stripped down, then that's a Hollywood story.
Right.
But this was our life with Joe. In fact, we felt strongly that many of his behavioral issues related to stress, and that much of the stress, this is just our feeling, that and much of the stress was generated by feeling different, and the biggest thing that made him different was what he called his secret from very early on, from about the age of 10 or 11 on. And we felt that if we could work on getting him more comfortable with the one thing, that the other things might settle out. And in fact, once he was out and comfortable and, you know, the gay kid at school, as it turned out, a lot of his odd behaviors receded at the same time. It's one of the things that, as a narrator, I leave hanging because I'm not, you know, I'm not a clinical psychologist or anything like that, but we had the satisfaction of seeing Joe get to be a little less odd and a lot more normal, while he's still as eccentric as can be.
I think the reader
still very much Joe.
I think the reader gets that satisfaction too, which is why this is just so well done. The text opens in your foreword with, as you mentioned, Joe's suicide attempt. And for folks, I'm not ruining the ending here,
Right. Spoiler.
Spoiler alert of ruining page one. It's not you who actually is there in that moment.
That's right. It's my wife.
And so what is that like for you to open the text of which you, as you said, you are the narrator with something that you did not bear direct witness to, though you're just so integral to what happened there?
It's a writing challenge.
Yeah.
It's, in terms of writing, as you're suggesting, a little bit of a hip fake.
Right.
Because I wasn't there. But I did not feel confident. I have done a book in which I supplied both voices, that I was writing what was essentially a reported memoir of another person, a book called Living Terrors, about bioterrorism, and it included the life experiences of Michael Osterholm. And we wrote the book together, but I was doing a lot of the writing, and I found myself writing in his voice for much of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not only unsatisfying, it left me feeling that I was not dishonest, but not genuine, if that's a distinction worth making.
Yeah.
And so I was not going to try to provide Gene's voice. And, you know, and when it comes to writing, I'm the guy that makes sentence, you know, knocks sentences together in the family. So I told it from my remove,
yeah.
from my perspective being across the Hudson. And then it gave the story from Gene's perspective later when we came into the actual event, retelling the actual event. And my thinking there really was that I could provide my perspective, and my perspective was one of terror that day, and I thought I could convey that to people through my voice.
Yeah, and I think, you know, in some ways, because you weren't there, it really gave the readers access that I think we may not have had it been Gene doing the writing right there. You know, you were slightly, and really, I say oh so slightly removed from it, as was the reader. So I just thought that was quite the entry point for the reader.
That sense of powerlessness that I think anybody can relate to.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're not there. Something happens and you're not there. That's what happens when you get the call from school. That's what happens.
Right.
You know, it's a nightmare scenario for a lot of people.
Yeah. I was reading David Sheff's New York Times book review of Oddly Normal, and in speaking about that piece, he writes about the levity in the book, and we're going to talk about that too, because levity is present, and I so appreciate that, because I think you easily could have left that out, but it would have been quite a different story. But he wrote, "Of course, the levity that permeates the book is possible because Joe's parents were lucky. Their son's suicide attempt failed, unlike many others, including the parents of Tyler Clementi." That word lucky really jumped out at me and was actually in some ways irksome to me, because I think that it was just much more complex than that. Is that a word that you and Gene take on?
Well, first of all, if you think I'm going to say a single negative word about the greatest, most amazing review I've ever seen in my life, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. When I saw that David Sheff had written a review in the first place, that was a huge moment. Gene and I had read Beautiful Boy, and we were stunned by the book. And
it's amazing,
and
yeah.
It was one of the books that allowed us to imagine that we could write a book, because it combined a personal story that was told with background and research, and what, you know, it was not a template, but a sort of.
You are making me feel so bad right now.
It's going to get worse. You'll be crawling by the end of this, because then I called up my wife. When I got a copy of the review in my hand, I called up my wife and I said, "Honey, you're not going to believe it. The review was written by David Sheff." And she went, "Oh my God, David Sheff, you're kidding me. Oh my God."
I'm going to move on to another topic.
No.
Everything in there is
We've
great.
We've got time. I'm going to turn the knife now. And I said, "And honey, there's not an unkind word in it."
Oh boy!
And for days afterwards, she said, "David Sheff, wow." So, to answer your question, well, no, I wasn't irked by that, really. I thought it was fine.
Okay.
I thought it was fine. And by the way, we do consider ourselves lucky.
Yeah.
Really, really lucky.
I'm moving on from this so quickly, I can't
even
tell you.
You sure you don't want me to just pummel you a little more?
I'm good.
I can go farther. Okay,
good.
Okay.
So at some point, I don't know how I'm going to, my mom is going to be so upset with me right now. Yes, no, it was the best review, and it was great having you on the show, and I wish you all well. No, you all, the best. 5 years of this show, this will be.
Completely derailed.
Oh, yeah, no.
So wrong.
Yeah, episode 223, and this is the most difficult transition that I've ever done. You all make a tour of PFLAGS, which I was quite riveted by that piece too. And I think that was a really salient moment for me, because as someone who was recommended to my parents, to, you know, go to a PFLAG meeting, there is that moment where you go to a couple PFLAG meetings and realize, and I can't imagine anyone listening to this show doesn't know parents and friends of lesbians and gays, but, where you realize, you know what, this meeting maybe is not for me, that it wasn't totally home for you all. Can you talk to me a little bit about kind of shopping around and finding a group that worked?
You know, but let's start out by saying that this is an amazing organization.
The best.
Many
people. Oh my gosh, yeah.
And that its national organization reaches out and you can get information and support there. And, you know, and they have an online component that's really rich in resources. So that's all really important.
Oh yeah.
I feel guilty today that I didn't say enough nice things about PFLY because I want people to go. I want people to enrich the organization. I think the organization helps people.
Yeah.
Having said all of that, in telling our story, honestly, we went to our first meeting and it was largely people of another generation and they had been through a different experience than we did. And they were telling stories about coming to grips with the terrible news that their child was gay and trying to work through those emotions. And they couldn't have been nicer, but it wasn't the experience we had. We wanted somebody to help us figure out, how do we encourage our child to come out? Our child is in pain and he's clearly gay and we just don't know whether or not to push him a little bit. We don't know how to give him support if he hasn't come out yet.
Right.
And it's like a next generation issue, if I can put it in those terms.
Oh yeah.
And so for that group, we were just on a different wavelength. And then we went into New York City to the LGBT center there, and we found a very different group. But its heart was in activism. And in that group, you know, it was fascinating, and there were great people there. But when we talked about Joe, there really was a sense especially from one of the parents, you know, you really need to push this kid out. You need to encourage him to get out. And then you need to encourage him to be an activist. And you can, you know, through the center, there are these things you can be involved in. You can be in videos and documentaries. And we left that meeting thinking, that's not Joe either.
Right.
You know, that's wonderful. This woman, this family was great. These people were great. But it's, again, a little different wavelength than we were on. Even today, I mean, Joe has done a couple of interviews. Joe has done a couple of book talks. I give him the opportunity to come talk with me when I go to places, but his answer is, no, you do that. You know, some things he has done. I mean, I found him doing more than I ever expected him to do. He's done online interviews, for instance, a beautiful piece in The Atlantic where he answered questions from Alice Drager. And I love him for it. But the idea that he was going to go out there and be an activist, a big activist, that would be the core of his being, it didn't look like that was where we were going with him.
Yeah.
So in those two groups, we didn't find the guidance that we needed right then. In fact, in the time, the people who were most helpful to me were our gay friends because I could ask them, what did you want? And guys I worked with and guys I'd grown up with and guys I'd met, who Gene and I called the League of Gay Uncles.
Love it.
You know, who I could simply say, our son is gay, he's not out. What would you have wanted? He's suffering, but we're not likely to push. What would you have wanted your parents to do? Would you have wanted them to say, we know you're gay? And of course the answer was no. No.
In fact, they said, and this is one of my favorite quotes from the book, they said, quote, most important, they said, don't be clever, please. Don't lift an eyebrow and murmur, quelle surprise, or say, Joe, you're the last to know. Making yourself look smart and funny and having a good coming out story for your friends isn't nearly as important as letting your son say this on his own terms and at the moment of his choosing. That's good stuff.
Thank you so much. It was important to say it.
Yeah.
And it was important to hear it from these friends, and it really shaped everything about how we approach Joe. Now, other kids, you know, you might need to push a little bit. I don't know. You know, it's not a how-to book. It's just what we did. But in our case, with one really big bump, it seemed to have worked out pretty well.
Nice. I said earlier, I mentioned French Woods. It was actually just one of my chuckle out loud moments, of many in the book. And for folks who don't know, French Woods, we actually just talked about it a few weeks ago because, it's where Adam Levine of Maroon 5 went to French Woods. It's a summer camp for the performing arts where many of us Northern New Jersey folks in Long Island go. And it was shortly after Joe was significantly struggling and had plans to go to French Woods, and you and Gene were making the decision, well, what do we do? Do we go or not? And the camp director actually told you all, let him come. Send him to camp.
Send him.
And I paused there and I thought, gosh, because I didn't know what was going to happen because I hadn't read the book yet. I was curious what you all were going to decide to do, because I would imagine that even after him saying that, you were thinking, is this the best idea?
He's not ready.
Yeah.
He's not ready. We're not ready. We had our hearts in our throats. We sent him because we agreed with him that he said, look, this is a therapeutic environment, and he'll be better off here than sitting in his room thinking about what happened.
Yeah.
And so we sent him, but we didn't sleep well. We waited for the phone to ring. We worried every day. Well, guess what? This is year 4 of Joe at French Woods.
Is he there right now? Great.
And for the first time, he's on a 6-week run. He has been in productions. The last couple of years, he wasn't. And then this summer, he again tried out for a production. It looks like if everything goes well and he doesn't freak out and he doesn't walk away, then when we go back to see him in a couple of weeks, we'll see him on stage in Mikado.
Look at that.
So, you know, I believe that the LGBT Center Yes program in New York City and French Woods saved Joe's life.
Wow.
They gave us our son back. They told him he wasn't alone. They told him he wasn't even that weird. And he needed to hear it. And he needed to hear it right then.
Yeah.
And I cannot say enough about French Woods and their environment and what it's meant to him.
Amazing. And I was really thinking in that moment, and I keep coming back to this word family, and I want to explore that a little bit more. But it was just this idea of there is this extended family that is out there supporting him, and love that. Part of your family, part of Joe's family, and something I don't think we talk about nearly enough are his siblings, Elizabeth and Sam. And they make appearances all throughout the book. Talk to me about the role of siblings in this process, in overcoming struggles.
It's important to know that they love you. It's important to know that they care. There was never a conflict between Elizabeth, Joe, and Sam. And by the time we had the crisis with Joe, by the time he came out, they were gone.
Yeah.
They're much older. You know, that this Joe is 5 and a half years younger than Sam, and 8 and a half years younger than Elizabeth.
Okay.
And so the raising Joe, by the time he was having most of his problems, was a little like raising an only child.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when his brother was at home, his brother was so active. Sammy is this magnificent athlete. He's a total jock. And by his junior and senior year in high school, he was on the football team and the wrestling team, and at one point on the lacrosse team as well. He was always at some game, some practice. And so he was not a big presence in Joe's life. Today, Joe and Sam get along great, but they don't have a lot in common.
Yeah.
You know, they've got the bond that a lot of brothers have. That I love you because you're my brother, but I barely know you. You know, there's no tension between them, but they're not going to talk about football and they're not going to talk about musicals.
Right.
Now, the beautiful thing is that Sam is an employee of French Woods Camp. And, you know, after Joe started going there, Sam, you know, like 2 years in, Gene said, wait a minute, you've got a gym? And we toured their facilities and had this magnificent gym and lots of athletic activities. And there's this whole sort of jock quadrant of the camp. And Gene said, well, Sam is a kinesiology minor at Penn State University.
Yeah.
He's a perfect candidate for this. She talked to them. They said, yeah, have him apply. He applied. They took a look at him. And this is his second year. He's there now. And he's really happy at the camp.
Love it.
As a, you know, as a counselor and all around dude. And so, you know, Sam is sort of there to look out for Joe too. But the hilarious thing is that on drop off day, when I went over to Joe's cabin and dropped him off and met one of the counselors, and, you know, he meets Joe and I say, well, we're going to go over and find Sam Schwartz now. And he said, well, do you know Sam? He said, he's my kid. He said, you're Sam Schwartz's father? Joe is Sam Schwartz's brother? Because Sam is, again, this great, amazing jock. And we are, you know, Joe is a rather flamboyant young man. And his parents are, you know, we're 5'3", and we do not especially look athletic or brawny or anything else. I mean, we're just a total mismatch as a family. It looks like somebody took family members off a shelf and jammed them together sometimes. But we get along.
You get along.
And Elizabeth is, again, 9.5 years older than Joe. She is actually married. She's living in Texas. But they adore each other. They have a very close bond. Joe and Elizabeth are super tight.
I love that the siblings, that they were throughout the book, and that we got a sense of them, because they're part of the landscape, part of your landscape, part of Joe's landscape. We were talking off the air about some folks commenting. As I was mentioning, my mom is reading the text right now, and I want her to read faster because she usually supplies me with questions, but she didn't finish in time for this one. But that some folks actually remark that it's a slow read for them, which I don't understand at all, except that I think, and one of the things we haven't yet mentioned, the text alternates between the memoir piece and your experiences as a family, also with more of a sense of the national landscape for LGBT issues and for mental health issues in this country.
Science, mental health, yeah. Culture. I tried to balance the story. In other words, the Christmas letter element with this foundation on which the story rests, which is all this stuff going on, this amazing moment of change in our
context.
Society.
Yeah.
And stuff that I've reported on. I've been a science reporter. I wrote about sexual orientation and genetic issues, and I've looked into and researched the history of the psychology community and psychiatric community and how they viewed homosexuality. And as legal correspondent, I'd written a lot about Prop 8 and DOMA. So, you know, this informed my writing of the book, and it had to be there.
I think those are the pieces that people are reading slower. I think in our reality TV culture, they can soak up the family, you know, the family experiences quickly. But then should they have to put it in a context? This is my theory that I've not yet tested.
Well, it could be.
It could be
you get to this family stuff that's difficult and people slow down because it's hard.
Yeah, or that.
I think everybody approaches the book from his own perspective. And I'm just glad that people are reading it. And I love the letters I get.
Oh, I bet.
From parents and from just so many gay men who have wanted to tell me their stories of growing up, what they went through. I had a friend come up, and, you know, a buddy whose wife and my wife used to have coffee together, and when we lived in another city, and our kids played, and he said, you know, I'm just really, really interested in the book.
Mm.
I've got a personal interest in the book. I said, well, why? Do you have a brother? Is this a family? He said, no, I'm gay. And I said, oh, well, does your wife know? And he said, yeah, I told her a few months ago.
Oh.
You know, it touches on people's experiences in ways that are not just related to raising this gay child.
Right.
It seems to open other doors too, and that's thrilling.
Now, just between us, nobody's listening, so we won't tell anyone.
Okay,
just between us, when DOMA was struck down and when the Supreme Court invalidated Prop 8, was there a part of you thinking, well, that stinks, now I got to rewrite that section?
Well, I'm
not saying you weren't happy, but was there a part of you that thought, well, that just made those couple pages out of date?
Yeah. Unfortunately, the paperback was already set.
See?
And so, you know, if somebody will let me go back and redo it, I rewrite all the time.
Yeah.
As a journalist working for a national newspaper, you're basically part essayist and part wire service reporter, and you're always revising everything. So having news change what you've been doing is nothing new to me. I found it interesting that I sort of called it wrong, that it was although I don't remember, I think I did do a revision that for the paperback that got a little closer to the nuance on the DOMA versus Prop 8 split. But I still think I'm very proud of the part of that discussion in which I suggested that Justice Kennedy's reasoning in Lawrence would move everything forward, because that's clearly what happened.
Oh, yeah, without question. Well, look, there's not a lot of text that I call my mom immediately and say, you need to read this straight away. There's a lot of text that she calls me straight away and says, you need to read this. But that's a whole different ballgame. And I just think there are so many different entry points, as you just said, in this text for any number of readers. But I think one of the greatest ones is you and Gene. And you two... The word I kept coming back to was the word advocates. And I felt like part of this was your process of learning what it meant to be an advocate, what it meant to just be out there and say, look, this is our son and we want the best for him. And she makes a brief appearance at the end of the book, and I wanted to hear more about her. So for the sequel, let's put her in there more. But your mom says at one point towards the end of the book, she says, quote, "I'm proud of Joe, but I'm really proud of you two for being so supportive."
And don't make me cry now.
I'm sorry. It's one of the things that I still have to make up for earlier in the interview, but it's one of the pieces that I walked away with thinking these are two parents with clearly amazing children and so honestly putting forth your struggles, but two parents who are really exploring that word advocate. And it is such an inspiration to me as someone who puts myself in that role as a human and as a college professor and whatever else it is that I do. And I think that you two really embody that. It really is a thing to behold.
Thanks. It is the thing that we had to become.
Yeah.
And we had to learn a lot, and we blew a lot along the way. That's what learning is, and it's nice to have gotten to a place where we think things started to work out, and even more satisfying, we see Joe standing up for himself now.
Yeah. It's great
stuff.
Boy,
does that feel good.
It's great stuff. Folks, you need to get out there wherever fine books are sold. The book's name is Oddly Normal. There's a Facebook page for it. You can look up John Schwartz there on the New York Times. By the way, your profile of Paul Smith was fantastic.
Thank you very much. That was such an inspiring piece to work on.
So, folks, check that out, too. The name of that piece is called A Lawyer's Evolution, Mirroring the Laws. John, what an absolute treat. Please send all of our best to Gene and Elizabeth and Sam, and of course to Joe.
Thank you for having me on the program. This is just wonderful.
And I can promise you right now, on next week's show will not be David Sheff, but it's something to work on.
Take care.
All right, folks, we interrupt this regularly scheduled podcast radio show, this show is So Gay episode, to bring you a very special event. I am sitting here right now at the Twist Social Club, our little remote studio, because coming up this weekend is the third annual International Ohio Burlesque Festival. So exciting. And my guest is already making me laugh with hand gestures, and it's radio, so you can't even see. But it's the third annual International Ohio Burlesque Festival, and here is the world-famous Bella Sin to talk about said festival. Bella, Welcome, I feel like, again, to This Show Is So Gay.
Hi, how are you?
For folks who don't know who you are, tell them how you have just performed everywhere.
I am your current reigning Cleveland burlesque queen, and I am one of Cleveland's most interesting people 2011. I'm also an LGBT advocate and a women's rights advocate.
Wow. Do I have a shot at being the burlesque queen 2014?
No.
Okay.
Boylesque, maybe.
Is there such a thing as boylesque?
Yes, there is, and we'll be seeing it at the festival this year.
Okay, we got to back up. We got to back up a step. For folks who do not know anything about burlesque, including, as I perhaps told you before the show, the woman who birthed me, who the misconception is, oh, it's just stripping. It's a lot more than that.
It's not just stripping. It's a big, huge, gaudy theatrical act, like Dixie said, and the Behind the Burlesque movie, people have this misconception that you can just put a corset and stockings and a petticoat and it will be burlesque. No, it's so much more than that. It's tantalizing. It's tempting. It's a theatrical show by a woman or a man dressed to the nines. And when I mean to the nines, it's small little tiny drag queens on stage, wow, per se. With rhinestones for days, boas, giant feather fans. It really should be a breathtaking, exciting 5 minutes of your life watching a burlesque performer. It's just how they can actually titillate and tantalize you and just hold you at the edge of their seat by taking off a glove. Now that's talent.
Love it. Love it. Now, according to the musical Gypsy, apparently you gotta have a gimmick. Does Bella Sin have a gimmick?
I used to have a gimmick, and then I got rid of it, and I just decided to be Bella. So it's unpredictable. I'm very much in love with old school burlesque and fan dancing. I'm very known for my fan dancing and my old school burlesque routines, and well, the Voodoo Priestess, that she's gonna come back soon. But I'm really known for my costuming. I don't consider even my nationality a gimmick. I just want to be able to have no boundaries and no stops, so I can actually thrive and grow with ideas.
Tell me what successful burlesque looks like.
Joe Weldon, the current reigning queen of burlesque, Lulu Devil. I admire so many people. Oh my God. Coco Electric, which is going to be coming to the festival. She just competed in the Burlesque Hall of Fame and for a queen competition. That's amazing. She's competing in New Orleans Burlesque Festival and she's won the titles there. Successful burlesque looks and feels in every single way, shape, and form, I believe, in my own personal belief, it just feels amazing and just right, and you know when you see it. And you would think that all these performers are like, you know, some of them are world fame, like Dito Antiz, yeah. But then we have, you know, like people like Joe Weldon is one of the people that I admire. She's gorgeous on stage, and Michelle Lamour with her fan dances, again, gorgeous on stage. It's success for burlesque. You just look up so many people, and you can have successful burlesque.
Now, you're sitting here right now on This Show Is So Gay. How gay-friendly is the world of burlesque?
Amazingly, lovingly gay-friendly. Our LGBT family is huge in the world of burlesque, and we embrace each other. It's really a beautiful place, really, in the world of burlesque for an activist like me, that I can see so much love and attention and coming in through that world. And really, we don't see, are you gay or straight? We just see family. And that, to me, is beautiful.
As the upcoming 2014 burlesque queen of Cleveland, I just am so... What do you mean, hopefully? I am so warmed by that. So the festival's coming up this weekend. It's not like you feel busy at all, right?
I haven't gotten any sleep. I work better under stress. Hopefully, we just have a couple of things to take care of, and then we're ready to roll.
Give me some background on the festival. How did you become involved in all this?
We started it. We saw an opportunity a couple of years back to actually where it was picking up in Cleveland, because I started in 2004 and I was one of the first. And back then they didn't even know what burlesque was for real. Like, they didn't even have a fathom of the idea of the history in Cleveland and the amazing history that we have here. And they're like, oh, never mind. We used to get kicked out of venues. We had to pay to play. We had to literally, I got dressed in the back seat of a Rio for a show that I performed for 2 seconds between two metal bands in 2005. So, I mean, some people wouldn't have even made it halfway back in the day. And it was really because of my drag mother, Danielle Vasquez, picking us up and putting us in the gay bars in the Inner Belt at Bounce. It was really how we started gathering fans and support. So we are investing now. Our model is we invest in the community that invested in us. So we invest back in the LGBT community. We invest back in Cleveland. Because if it wasn't for those individuals that really sat down and taught us, I learned so much from Danielle, like costuming, makeup, hair. I did look like a drag queen for a minute. And I'm okay with that. I'm totally okay with that. But, you know, it's because of those people that invested in us that La Femme has now, next year is our 10th anniversary. Wow. And it's my 11th year in burlesque, and I'm only 28. Going to be 29 this year. So that says something. And
that the people is that amazing. So the third annual, this is exciting. It's not the first, it's not the second, the third. And so you guys have, like, hit your stride. And I am looking at a guest list that is pretty insane. It's an insane guest list.
55 international entertainers from all over the world. Like, we have people from London, we have people from Canada, we have people from Austin, Texas, we have people from San Francisco, we have people from New York, we have people from Colorado. We have more people from Cleveland, we have people from Ohio. It's picked up, and it's 2 days now, so it's so much more. We also have the Buckeye Burlesque Academy, like, every year, the Boston Baby Dolls.
Right, because I was seeing that you can learn. There are classes. I could perhaps learn how to then become the 2014 yep. Cleveland Burlesque Queen. I feel like if I say it enough, it'll stick, and I'll just be crowned without even showing up.
You know what? That title was given to me by the Cleveland Scene a couple of years ago, and it was so overwhelming because in 2010, it started picking up more, and then in 2011, it was like Cleveland Magazine, Cleveland Scene cover, and then the Akron Beacon Journal cover, and just all these articles just started going on. It was so overwhelming. Because they're like, Bella, I'm like, whoa, you know me. I know. I don't know you.
But if I get enough listeners to write in recommending me, do I even have to show up? Is there a possibility I could get crowned the 2014 queen without showing up?
You have to stand on stage with me and see how you do.
We'll get to that. But yes, you could go to classes. So what are they going to teach us in these classes?
The Who's Who in Burlesque, that's one. The boa dancing class, choreography for one, history lessons.
Yes, I love that there's going to be history. Because there's a really rich history to burlesque.
We did. We've been working on a documentary we released this year for Remember the Roxy. The Roxy used to be our burlesque house here in Cleveland, and we're very, very fond of it. We just met with the city a couple weeks ago, and we actually passed the committee, the streetscape committee, for a marker. So now we're just going to the Capitol and grabbing our marker. So we work a lot on our historical projects because where I come from in Mexico, we remember what came before us, and it's important to remember what came before us here, because not a lot of people know that the Roxy used to be there, that Short Vincent used to be there, and you have all these people that used to be there and used to have this amazing love for it, and they just disappeared, and you don't know what happens, and it gets me really sad when I talk about it, because all these people worked so hard for this, and they thought that was going to be eternal to a certain point in time, and then
Just goes away.
Yeah, and I don't want their memory to go away. So I want them to keep it alive somewhere, somehow, that, you know, 50 years from now, when the next revival comes around, hopefully, you know, it's there for people to remember. I think we're calling the project a remarkable memory, because it is really a remarkable memory in Cleveland, and we've been working nonstop to make it happen. And that's how we got La Femme Mystique Burlesque got Best Trip of the Year. So in Ohio, so that was a very wonderful, humbling thing that we saw with the Golden Buckeye Awards, which is something that we created in 2011 with a festival. So we can actually start acknowledging the leadership and activism and volunteering that's going on in Ohio. So that way, you know, I see all these people doing so much stuff and barely thank you sometimes come in. You get a volunteer shirt and some food and a water, you know, and that's your thank you sometimes, and the hugs and the smiles of other people. And me being a volunteer too, I decided to start forming something to recognize those other people out there, and all the directors supported us in it. So this year the list is amazing. Through the 2 days that we're going to be doing burlesque, we're actually also going to be acknowledging our community. So we have people like Gareth with the AIDS Task Force, Todd Separator from Cleveland Pride, I mean, it's going to be freaking
got
amazing.
People in the social club who are cheering for you right now.
So it's just going to be an amazing event. It was like these 2 days are 2 days of Cleveland, of Ohio, being looked at internationally. And you're not going to see this caliber of performances in classes and in the year. You have to go outside. And this is a way I can bring in what I see outside because I go compete often.
Yeah.
And I go to festivals representing Cleveland. And what people see is me. They see Cleveland in me. So I have to be, we have to be poised. We have to be ready. We have to give them the rock and roll feeling. And we have to shake the stage. So
do we want people to go to the Facebook page? How do we want people to connect with the festival?
OhioBurlesque.com. That will give you all the details, ticket Perfect. Information. It's being held at the Beachland Ballroom in the historical Waterloo neighborhood. It used to be the creation Liberty Home, actually, in 1950s.
Wow.
And Cindy came in and renovated it and made it into one of the most eclectic music clubs in Cleveland. And they have great food.
I haven't been there yet.
You have to go.
I just moved here.
Welcome to Cleveland. Cleveland is awesome. And you can also go to our Facebook, Ohio Burlesque, or La Femme Mystique Burlesque, or Bellison.com, and find all the details, posters, and stuff. And also you can hashtag OBF13 and find all the crazy pictures that we're posting, because God knows they're crazy. So, and they're going to get even crazier, because all the girls are, when as soon as they come here, we're going to be switching to our Instagrams and social media. We're trying to really push our social media.
Yeah.
So everybody can see what is really out there. And that's how people live nowadays, in their phones. God knows, if you read a newspaper, which I love reading the newspaper.
Look at that.
Yeah, I know. Reading. It's fundamental, hunties. So, yeah, I really hope that everybody makes it to the festival. I really hope everybody's working really hard. Tani Novak, Constantinople Darling, Eric Paul Owens, like, Corey Gortran. There's people, Fam Andy and Jamie Moore, they have been our same MCs. It's this little family we created since year one.
I want to volunteer. Is there room for me to do something?
Yes.
I'll work a table. I will happily. I love doing this. Well, this is so exciting.
Oh, we forgot something.
Tell me.
This is also a fundraiser for Equality Ohio.
That would be a big thing.
Yes.
That would be a big thing. Equality Ohio doing just incredible work, not just on marriage equality, but just on so many issues affecting the LGBT community.
You know what? This is a way, that's a fun way, not to push things on people, but to inform them. I was like, you know, some people don't know that you can actually get legally fired from your job.
Totally.
Here for being, you know, gay, and they don't have to be a reason. Like, having, if there's a hate crime, it will not be recognized as a hate crime. And it's a lot of, like, the transgender rights. People don't know all this stuff. And it drives me crazy that you can be sitting here and your brother is gay and you don't know this, or your sister is gay. Even just being an ally, you might not know this stuff. And the stuff that we want to tell people is like, hey, you know what? There's real injustice happening. I know we want Prop 8 and we want DOMA. And even now with the war on women right now, it's just like stuff that we need to tell people about.
Yes.
Because if you don't know, you don't become informed, you don't become active, you don't become the change that needs to happen in your community. So Equality Ohio is going to be there. We're going to try to fund them as much as possible. So if you see them at a festival, give them money. Don't care if they say yes or no, just give it to them.
Give it to them.
So it goes to a good cause every year. The first year was Domestic Violence Center. The second year was MS. So this year is going to be, we're the first one of a few festivals that takes a political stand and is a fundraiser for their city. So I'm very proud of our Heartlands Festival.
Can I tell you, I am so excited to go.
You should be. This is all going to be naked people.
And maybe you and I, you can help me, because I want to work on my soon-to-be world-famous hoodie burlesque.
Hoodie burlesque.
I think that's going to be my gimmick. It's going to be
the hoodie.
Does someone have it already?
I don't know. You have to Google that. I always tell new performers, like Google your name and see that nobody's named like you, or even the same last name, because God knows they used to be No Bellas when I first started, or Bella Swan from Twilight. Then out of nowhere, like, Bellas everywhere. I was like, what's going on? I'm not an individual. But it's like my identity. But Google your burlesque number before you start it.
Okay.
Make sure that you start, you know, forming your persona and really stay true to who you are, because
nice.
That's how you're going to find success. You're not going to be like, oh, I want to be a siren. I want to be the mysterious, you know, Dita Von Teese, like, clone. Dita Von Teese is Dita Von Teese. Joellen
right.
is Joellen. You want to be your own individual.
Bellison is Bellison.
And she's effing crazy. See, I censored myself.
Very good. Well, from the former Cleveland burlesque queen to the soon-to-be Ken Schneck burlesque queen.
Well, you'll be burlesque Boylesque King. We have
I'm shooting for the other one. I'm telling you, I'm breaking down barriers left and right.
How you can tassel twirl against me? That's going to be an interesting ceremony.
Or maybe I'll just work a table. Folks, go and check out the 3rd annual International Ohio Burlesque Festival, Bella Sin. You got to come back on the show.
Oh, of course I will come back on the show. You've seen me all over already. He's doing something.
Which means I've been all over already. Folks, go check out the festival. Bella, an absolute treat.
Thank you.
Juice can pull all the stops out till they call the cops out. Grind your behind on your band. But you gotta get a gimmick if you wanna get a hand. You can sacrifice your sacro. Working in the back row. Bulk in a dump till you're
That's how burlesque was born.
So I and I and I but I do it with a horn.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, not a lot of time left on this week's episode, so we will throw some LGBT news out at you real, real quick. We turn our attention to Russia. Folks have written in to us. You can send those emails on over to ken@thisshowisokay.com and said, why haven't you said anything about Russia? It wasn't intentional. We just got swamped in the past couple weeks with other stuff. But yes, the anti-gay practices in Russia, the anti-gay laws there are just, they just make your mouth drop open, and the experiences I particularly enjoy, well, not enjoy, but it's good to read the actual experiences of LGBT Russians, not just kind of the legal analysis of the laws and how it might affect people. But there's a lot of pieces out there, and they're really easy to find, of Russian LGBT folks in their own voices talking about how these laws affect them. So, of course, the big question coming up is, well, the Olympics is going to be in Russia, and what's going to happen there? So the campaign in the U.S. and abroad, and certainly in Russia as well, continues against these anti-gay laws. So first, there was the boycott of Russian vodka that began here in the U.S., and then it was duplicated in Great Britain, over there in England. Then Senator Ed Markey, a Massachusetts Democrat who sits on the Foreign Relations Committee, he sent out a letter to the Russian ambassador condemning Russia's horrific practices and policies, including bans on any speech that is remotely pro-equality. He said he's concerned, Senator Markey, he's concerned about how these laws will play out when Russia hosts the Olympics. He said, quote, while I strongly oppose the existence of such a discriminatory statute that singles out one group of individuals because of their sexual orientation, several of the law's provisions are so vague and loosely defined that they could jeopardize the safety of the thousands of American athletes, spectators, and support staff who will be visiting Russia next year as part of the 2014 Winter Olympic Games. So that's what Senator Markey wrote. The International Olympic Committee, they recently announced that they received verbal assurances from the Russian government that the new law that would really condemn gay people and any pro-equality speech, that it would not be enforced against foreigners during the Olympics. And folks are calling this, quote, a welcome development, which is kind of ridiculous. I mean, yes, this law will go into effect right after the Olympics, or it will be suspended during the Olympics. That's just kind of a weird way of all of us condoning what's happening in Russia. So we will, of course, keep our eyes on Russia. It's pretty nutty there. And, you know, the Olympics, which is unity, and that's not what's happening in Russia right now. And a lot of folks on their Facebook pages I was reading today are drawing comparisons to what happened in Germany and boycotts there. So keeping our eyes on the Olympics, keeping our eyes on Russia. The quote of the week goes to Ira Thomas, who is a teacher and pastor from South Carolina. He was a recent attendee of the National Education Association's convention in Atlanta, And he claims that he has been, quote, accused of hating because he opposed the, quote, indoctrination plans that the NEA is putting into place. Because what they're putting in place, if folks don't know the NEA, they are putting into place an LGBT inclusive curricula, which is pretty darn great. So this is his quote, Ira Thomas. He said the quote of the week is, quote, to me, it's like teaching people about how to use crack. It's a dangerous game to play on. Let's do that one again. To me, it's like teaching people about how to use crack. It's a dangerous game to play on. So yeah, he's just flat out there on a conservative radio show, of all places, that's shocking, comparing adopting an LGBT inclusive curricula to teaching kids how to use crack. And you, sir, you get the quote of the week. He did go on to say, he took it one step further. He not only claimed that the National Education Association is corrupting children, but he said that the organization was, quote, the reason why this culture has been slouching toward Gomorrah. Not Sodom, by the way. Gomorrah, that's what he says. And then there's one interesting legal case that I wanted to throw out at you. So in a 2011 trial of an antitrust fight between two giant drug companies, a potential juror appeared to reveal that he was gay. A lawyer for Abbott Laboratories used a peremptory strike, which is something that lawyers can use to get rid of a juror, to disqualify them, and it doesn't require a reason. And so it eliminated him from the jury pool. An opposing lawyer objected, saying the juror, quote, is or appears to be, could be, homosexual. That mattered, the lawyer said, because, quote, the litigation involves AIDS medications, and the incidence of AIDS in the homosexual community is well known, particularly gay men. So this is now actually going before the federal appeals court in California, which is going to decide whether or not being gay can be a basis for being disqualified from being in a jury. I am fascinated by this. In legal terms, the lawyer tried to raise a Batson challenge, which is named after a 1986 Supreme Court decision, Batson versus Kentucky. That decision recognized an exception to the general rule that peremptory challenges are completely discretionary. Race, the court said in that case, cannot be the reason. And then 8 years later, the court said that gender cannot be the reason. But the court has never addressed sexual orientation. So very interesting legal fight. If simply identifying as gay can be a reason to be disqualified from being on a jury. Love these 2.0 things. We'll find out. And we'll talk about it next week with Jimmy Wynn. And I know that I promised on Facebook he was going to be on this week's episode, but we had some poor time management on this week's episode, so we just couldn't fit Jimmy in because we wanted to give a shout out to the Burlesque Festival happening here in Cleveland. I'm going to be working the performer check-in. I'm really excited about that. So I'm going to be meeting all of the burlesque performers. So huge thank you to Bella Sin, who was on earlier in the show, and can't wait to see her do her thing. And of course, to author John Schwartz and his whole family for putting the book out there, Oddly Normal. What a great chat with him. That's pretty much it for this week's episode. Get out there, folks. Go do some incredible, incredible things. Please use your voice the way that you know how to use it. And it's very individual to you. You use it in a very specific way, but use it the way that you know how to use it to make a difference for your LGBT brothers and sisters and, of course, all of our allies. Gosh, what a great ally, John Schwartz and his family. They're advocates, one and all. Get out there, folks. Go do some incredible things. And please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?
Now the homecoming time. Take the top up, and who knows what you might find. Won't confess all my sins. You can bet I'll try it, but you can't always win. 'Cause I'm a gypsy.